Hey friends, this is Fun Therapy, and my name is Mike Foster. And together we're going to dive into the messy and brutal, but oh-so-beautiful parts of our not-so-perfect stories. And so much of finding freedom involves surrender, of letting go, of laying down something we have carried for far too long. Letting go of shame, letting go of fear, letting go of control, letting go of the unhelpful stories we've told ourselves for far too long. You see, we must lose our life in order to find it. And we must come to the end of ourselves in order to begin the story that awaits us. My name is Mike Foster, and this is Fun Therapy. Well, I'm so excited for you, my friends, to hear today's conversation with Malcolm McLaughlin as we journey into the truth and the lies about addiction and the most powerful thing you can do for somebody who is struggling with addiction right now. Friends, before we dive in, I want to remind you that registration for my two-day Fun Therapy event is open right now. It's May 16th and 17th in Carlsbad, California. That's in San Diego area. The event is called Strongest, and it's 2 days filled with teaching and conversations, Q&A with yours truly. I'm also inviting everyone over to my house for a dinner party on the first night. It's going to be a beautiful evening. We're going to do a live taping of Fun Therapy, and we just have a few spots left. It has filled up really fast, and I'm trying to work out a way to open up a few more spots, but unfortunately, there's no guarantee at this point. So if you want to come, make sure to register soon. And by the way, thank you for your overwhelming response to this. I love that you want to invest in your future self, invest in your personal development, invest in your heart and your passions. So if you want to come, get registered today and don't wait. You can learn more at my website at mikefoster.tv. Get all the details and register at mikefoster.tv. Also want to say thanks too for your reviews and on iTunes. I thought I'd just read a few because I so appreciate when you do that. It's so helpful for the podcast. And I want to read a couple that came in last week. ELH says this: binge listening. I discovered the Fun Therapy podcast just a couple months ago and have been binging to catch up on every episode from the beginning. I don't know what I'm going to do once I'm caught up and have to wait between episodes. Oh no, I guess that's a good problem to have. We'll keep those episodes coming. And Sugar Boots, what a fantastic nickname, by the way. Sugar Boots. Sugar Boots left this review. This podcast is life-giving. Make sure to make this a part of your life. You'll be healthier for doing it. And they go on to say that you are not alone. Well, I love that, friends. Thanks for taking the time to leave those reviews. And if you haven't, and you're been listening to the podcast and you haven't rated it or left a review on iTunes, and you have found this content helpful for you, please leave a quick review. In fact, pause this. If you're listening, just pause this right now. Hit the pause button and go leave a review and then come back. It will take you 5 seconds to hit the stars, but I'll still be here. I'll be waiting. I'll wait for you. Leave your short review, and I might even share it here on the podcast in the upcoming weeks. Okay, so on today's episode of Fun Therapy, Malcolm McLaughlin sits down with me and shares about his downward spiral into addiction and how he found life and hope in the most unlikely place. Malcolm is a ultra runner, a musician, an autism activist, and the author of the book, The Second Lap. I cannot wait for you to hear from him. You will be challenged and enlightened by this beautiful and challenging story of transformation.
Grew up in rural Ireland in a really small town in the Republic in a county called Offaly, and you know, it's your typical small Irish town, lots of pubs, Catholic church, and, you know, there's no such thing as an alcoholic in Ireland. You're just, you know, it's your Irish. That's the kind of running joke. But family were all drinkers, lots of uncles and aunts. And yeah, I had my first ale when I was 11 years old at a Christmas party, and, you know, was sick as a dog after it. But it was just a thing to do. There was not a lot happening when I was, you know, 14 or 15. We'd get my sister's boyfriend to buy us booze, and we'd hang out and, you know, play rock music. We were big into Pearl Jam at the time, and it just progressively, you know, in my late teens, got into smoking pot, got into drinking a bit more, and then was, you know, was always trying to explore what the limits were. So stuff like LSD and magic mushrooms entered the fray pretty quickly. And I moved to Australia when I was 22, because I just couldn't handle the small town life anymore. And over there, it was paradise. You know, lots of new people, lots of clubs, lots of bars, lots of, you know, more psychedelics, lots of weed, lots of booze. And, you know, by the time I was finished there, I decided I'd move to London. And that, I think, was when the hook really went in, because it went from being a spiritual kind of enlightenment thing to wanting to get really wasted. And I ended up working in the bar scene, and I was working in like these amazing restaurants as a manager, where at all these, you know, famous people for customers, like the guys from U2 and Coldplay and all these actors. And I managed to get this dream job managing this restaurant, and I was doing, you know, cocaine on a nightly basis, drinking early in the morning, then, you know, doing coke all night to keep myself awake. And then it got into stuff like, you know, smoking crack and basically anything that was put in front of me. And it was one of those things where I didn't really see it coming. It had its hooks firmly into me before I even knew what was going on. And when I tried to pull out of it, I just realized that I couldn't. And on paper, essentially, I had this amazing life. I could get into any club. I could go anywhere. I could, you know, hang out with anybody I wanted to, got free drugs. But inside, I was dying. There was this torment in me that I couldn't believe I was so held so captive by this, you know, inanimate object. It's just a glass with liquid in it and condensation bubbles running down the side, but yet it sucked me in, and it was the thing that made me feel the most alive. But it was also the thing that, when I had too much of it, it made me just want to kill myself.
So what do you think, in terms of that season for you, as you look back and sort of process it, what was the thing below the surface, or maybe even below the alcohol and the medicating and the escape? What do you think was a driver for you?
I think a lot of it was to do with being accepted for who I was, for who I am, and for the talents, I think, and the gifts that I have. I think there's a certain persona that comes with living that kind of a lifestyle. I'm quite a hyperactive person, and I have like one gear, and that's like go. So when I do something, I do it to the max. But it had become such a part of my identity that I thought if I didn't have it, they would see that, you know, I was a fraud. And that I was just this deeply flawed human being. And that, if, you know, nobody would love that person. But if I could plaster over the cracks of it with this kind of superficial personality, then I could get away with it. You know, this kind of fake it till you make it type thing. But it was just like throwing gasoline on a fire, because it just got worse. And the drunker I got, the more depressed I got. And the funny thing is, like with addiction, you think you can run away from it. And after being in London for 7 years, I'd met a French woman there, and we had two kids, and we decided to move to this quaint little suburb in Western Paris where I have lived for the last 11 and a half years. And she got a job promotion, and we moved to France. And I thought, all I have to do is leave the bar and leave the, you know, I'll leave the addiction behind, but wherever you go, there you are. And I got to this country where I didn't know the language. I didn't know the culture. I had no friends. I had gone from being, you know, the king of the party scene to not knowing anybody. And that's when it really spiraled out of control, and the depression got worse. And, you know, my daughter was diagnosed with autism when she was 2.5, and me and my wife weren't getting on, and my drinking was causing a lot of problems. And we ended up, you know, we were heading for divorce. And there was no way out of this for me. I thought, you know, I tried to quit before, but I couldn't do it. So it became this thing where it was like, in order just to survive and get through the day, I had to get up in the morning and have like 8 beers. And that kind of came to a head in 2010, where I just had this epiphany one day when I was drunk at a barbecue, that if I kill myself, then the problem will be over. You know, my kids will have no dad, but at least my hope would be that some guy would come along and be the dad in their lives that they needed. Because the state I was in, I certainly couldn't have done it. So it went from being, you know, a dependence to kind of mask the flaws of me and the imperfections in me, to this thing where, like, if I didn't get a drink, I felt like I was gonna die. And then one day in August, after that barbecue, I basically told my son and my soon-to-be ex-wife that I was going to go for a jog in the forest. And I went to the, I went down to the garage, and I got this rope and went to the store, bought a six-pack, found this remote part of the forest, and put this rope around the branch of a tree, and was just about to jump, and I just saw this vision of a person hanging, and this voice that just said to me, this is not the path for you. And that was kind of the first thing that jarred me into kind of like, whoa, there's something bigger going on here. And after that, then I kept drinking for probably another 3 months, and the real kind of like hammer to the head moment came when my son found me like dying of a hangover after a 2-day binge in this stinky room that I hadn't crawled out of. And at 6 years old, he said, Papa, please stop drinking. I don't want you to die. And that was just the epiphany that I knew, like, I had probably, this was probably the last shot I had.
Addiction is often been described as a hole being filled by another hole. Whatever the drug of choice is, it may feel like a solution when really it's this deep spiritual black hole that we're falling into. A hole that eventually takes us deeper and deeper into a story we never desired. As Malcolm described it, he said he didn't see it coming, and it had its hooks in him before he even realized it. And perhaps the most dangerous thing about addiction is that it all makes so much sense. It works so well until it doesn't. And here's what we need to clearly understand. Whether you're struggling with addiction or numbing out with Netflix or food or just covering your wounds with performance or perfectionism, listen, any attempt to escape from your pain will only create more pain. You see, freedom isn't found in running from, but moving towards the pain we feel inside.
Like, I had been sober before for like 9 months one time and 6 months for another time, and I'd done AA and it didn't really work for me. I know it's worked for a lot of people, but it didn't just... Listening to people talking about booze at meetings made me want to go out and hook up like a gin IV or something. I'm like, this is not helping me. But I Yeah, and I think the first conscious thing in my mind was, I need to get social. Because what a lot of people from the outside looking into addiction, they see addicts and they go, okay, this person's really selfish. This person cares only about themselves. This person is shutting everybody out of their lives because they don't care about them. It's actually not like that. When you're an addict, you shut the people out because you don't want to hurt them anymore. You want to preserve them. And the way you do that is you kind of sit in the corner with your drug, whether it's booze or coke or whatever, and you want to spare them that pain. And that's what, you know, I had done for such a long time. But I said to myself, okay, dude, if you want to get better, you need to reach out to people. And it was through like a running website at the time that I reached out to a guy who lived in the Paris area and hooked up with him. And that was the beginning of a transformation in my life. I think the fact that I sought somebody in a time when I had nobody was what I needed, because that person came alongside me and walked with me through the mess and just loved me. You know, just straight up loved me. We had lunch together. We hung out together. I, you know, got to just evacuate all the stresses and worries and shame. But yet this person loved me, even with all the faults and foibles and stuff that I had tried for so long to cover up with the booze. So that was kind of a revelation for me at that time.
Yeah, I've heard it once said, and I share it often, is that whole idea of the opposite of addiction isn't sobriety, but the opposite of addiction is connection.
Yeah.
And the idea of you connecting into relationship was the pathway for you to start this new season.
Absolutely.
Sobriety. So tell me, as you walked through this and are still walking through it in the sense of this is an ongoing development of who you are and moving towards, you know, just every day is a step towards more health and more freedom. But what do you think is the thing that you wanted or would want people to understand about you and your addiction or the addict mindset back in those dark days? What do people not understand about that moment and those moments of your life?
About the dark times?
Yeah.
It's indescribable. I mean, the joke I used to have with people was I'd go to somebody's apartment and they'd say, open a bottle of wine. So I'd open the bottle of wine. And then they'd say, make sure you keep the cork. I'm like, what's the cork for? And they go, leftover wine. And I go, what's leftover wine? Mm. When you're addicted to something, like the coke and the mushrooms and the acid and the crack and all that stuff, I could kind of interchange, but booze was my everything. It was like, the best way I can describe it is when I drink alcohol and it goes into my system, it's like something out of a Spider-Man movie where they show like Peter Parker's DNA changing and sinking into this, you know, synchronizing into this perfect helix where everything aligns and everything is perfect. When alcohol mixes with my blood, it is this euphoria that surpasses pretty much everything. And you can get a few of those beers into you and still remain that high. But if someone tries to cut you off and say you've had enough, like you just turn into a different beast. It's like no man, woman, child, or whatever will stop me or get in the way of me getting my next fix. It's just, the power of it is incredible. And the deviosity it drives you to is the stuff of legend. Like addicts are the sneakiest, bunch of people, and you're making up excuses for what you're doing, and you're hiding it, and you're fooling nobody, only yourself, because everybody knows what you're up to. The really dark days were the days when, you know, I just hid stuff at a level that I think people in the future will still uncover in their homes or something. Like, I would go to a guest house and we'd be having casual drinks, and I'd go to the bathroom or something, and I'd maybe pass through their kitchen and find like a bottle of Johnny Walker whiskey or a bottle of gin. And I'd like look around the corner and everybody would be animatedly in conversation, and I would unscrew the cap, drink half the bottle, and then go to their sink and fill the rest up with water and put it back on the shelf. You know, or just hiding cans of booze. Anytime we moved, I remember one time I was back home in Ireland for Christmas with my kids, and my mom said that I was there for a week. And after she cleaned out the bedroom that I was in, she found like, I don't know, hundreds of beer cans under the bed. It was just nonstop, like all the time. First thing in the morning, I would have to have a drink. No, I'd get up and I'd like retch and purge my system, and then I'd start drinking. And then I'd take an hour or two off in the afternoon and then start in the evening, because if I didn't get it, I would just, yeah, I didn't know what I was going to do. I had to have something close to me at all times. Like I'd have, I used to have bottles of vodka hidden in the, you know, you call it in the States, like the cistern of the toilet, you know, where the flusher is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd have like a bottle of vodka on a piece of string down there, or I'd have like beer cans hidden around the bath or in the shower or in the toilet. It was just everywhere. And like it consumed everything I did. Everything took second place. Friendships were relegated. I lost contact with people I'd known for years because I just became so, this thing was my sole focus for like the better part of 15 years.
I mean, what you're describing and what you're experiencing and how it sort of, how the addiction played out in your story, it really goes to that, to me, one of the greatest misconceptions of addiction is that it's just a willpower issue. It's like, you know, talk to me about that of just, because I would assume there's a desire somewhere inside of you that says, I need to stop. This is broken. This isn't what I want for my life. And yet being overwhelmed by what's happening.
Yeah, that's the great myth, the whole willpower thing, because ultimately it's not, the way I look at it is it's not a behavior modification, it's a heart transformation. Mm-hmm. And there has to be some sort of transformation in the heart. I mean, I think willpower, strategy is more important than willpower. Like when I quit smoking, I strategized. So, you know, favorite cigarettes of the day are usually the morning, then the afternoon after lunch, and then the evening. So you can exchange that. You can have a piece of fruit. You can go for a walk. You cannot hang around the people outside your office who go for a smoke. You can maybe go to somewhere else and grab a coffee. So you can strategize a certain amount of it, but willpower is absolutely not enough. And I think that's where people who don't understand addiction get really frustrated with the addicts that are around them. Because the expression is always the same. Why can't you just stop? Mm-hmm. Because I'm addicted. Mm-hmm. That's why. You know, and in my kind of work and going around and like speaking and writing and stuff, I hear the same thing from gambling addicts. I hear the same thing from porn addicts. I hear the same thing from cocaine addicts, from alcoholics. You can't just stop. There has to be a transformation in some way, shape, or form. And for me, it was the kind of the 1-2 punch of, or like the, it was like a 1-2-3 punch of the epiphany, the pre-suicide epiphany, then the epiphany when my son said what he did, and then the action of getting into community and working through the stuff and not having somebody say to me, hey, you know, you just need to stop, or you just need to be perfect, or you just need to be, you just need to fit in this little box. A lot of it is embracing messiness, and, you know, people relapse and people fall down. But I think if you can keep yourself surrounded by the right people, then, you know, and in some cases in what I do, you know, with meeting with people and talking with people, sometimes it's enough for me to be able to walk with them, or for them to be able to walk with a sponsor. Sometimes there's, you know, a professional therapist or a behavior therapist is needed, but you have to keep going towards the light. But community's paramount.
The pathway out of addiction is not through willpower. It's not through just saying no. It's not through isolating yourself or keeping secrets. But the pathway to freedom is through connection and relationship. Malcolm's choice to move from isolation to connection was his superpower move. It was the decision that saved his life. So often when we're struggling, we think it's just best to shut people out in order to protect them. You think isolation and secrecy is the best way to protect loved ones from you and your pain and your secrets and your addiction. And yet this is self-destructive thinking. What will save you? Relationship. What will save you? The friendship of others. What will heal you? Being seen and known. What sets you free? Boldly stepping into the light.
I thought there was no way out. I thought there was two ways. One was the suicide, and the second one was my, what I used to call, suicide by installment plan, which was basically a longer version of killing yourself. Just by, you know, you get cirrhosis of the liver, or your organs shut down, and you kind of die gradually and painfully. But I was terrified of never kind of discovering who I am or what I was called to do. And I'm really thankful, actually, that, you know, it did happen in my early 30s. You know, I didn't want to get to be like 40 or 50 or 60 and be still this guy doing the same thing and have all these people love me and me turn away from them. And the fact that, you know, I almost left two kids without a dad, and as my son grows into a teen, I just love spending time with him more and more and more. And, you know, even with my daughter with her autism and the challenges that brings, I just adore her, and that could have all been taken away from me.
So tell me. That's so powerful, Malcolm. I mean, talk about a sobering thought, right? Of just to allow the addiction to work its course, and where, you know, addictive behaviors, whatever they might be, they ultimately lead to a life, I think, of isolation, and a life that no one ever wanted to sign up for.
And that breaks my heart. I mean, I could count in like 10 seconds on two hands the amount of close friends I have that have committed suicide through addiction. There's so many others I've lost because of overdoses. There's so many people who I see and meet who are struggling and who don't have essentially the success story that I have. And that breaks my heart because so many of them think that it can't get any better. That it can't get any better. And even if there's somebody listening right now who is wasted on something or who is feels like they're at death's door, like I am living proof that it's possible, that there is turnaround, that there is redemption, that there is life, a new relationships, that if we deep down just go to that heart place and go, I want to transform my life. There are people out there that you can align yourself with who in 2 or 5 or 10 years time, I mean, who knows what the possibilities are? It's just sad when people are caught in the throes of it and to think, this is my life, this is all it's ever going to be, this is, there's hope. There's always, always, always hope. As long as you've got a breath in you, there's hope.
So tell me about something that you shared about online and you wrote about on your blog about December. And just a few months ago, you were, I think, almost eight years into your sobriety, and something popped up.
Yeah, I don't blog as much as I used to, but I always make sure that I put a kind of a milestone of gratitude, I guess, for each year of sobriety. And each year you go through different kind of emotions. You know, the first year, you're still on, you know, baby legs. You're like, whoa, I made it this far. And a lot of relapse usually happens between like the 7 month to a year and a half. At least from people I've spoken to, that's not like scientific research or anything, but it's because you kind of get this confidence that you've made it this far and you forget that you're an addict and you go, if I just have one, and then you're back down the path. And by year 2 and 3, you're starting to kind of go, wow, this is amazing. Like this is 3 years. By 5 and 6, I was, you know, I had written about it in a memoir and had been fortunate enough to kind of speak at some different places in the US and in Europe. And that kind of got the sobriety thing some traction, and I just ended up, you know, through the website and stuff and through social media, lots of people like would reach out, and especially lots of people who have not so much addicts, but more family members of addicts kind of saying, you really helped me understand what addiction is like. But by the time I got to 7 years, I thought, dude, I'm rocking this. Like I'm like the sobriety dude. I'm like this ultra running guy. And yeah, look at me. I'm fantastic. Not in an arrogant way, but I thought, I have this thing licked. You know, I can maybe let the guard down a little bit. And coming up to 8 years, on the 12th of December, about a week before that, I got some news that shouldn't have bothered me that much, but I kind of had been in line for this thing that I was hoping was going to kind of come my way, and then it went to somebody else. And this, like, blinding, I was sitting at home, it was like a Thursday afternoon or something, and was just working on my computer, and I got the news and had the conversation with this guy, and it just like blindsided me. And I got really sad for a minute, and then the rage just boiled up, like completely unchecked rage, and I was just furious. And it does take a lot to get me angry, but this was like, you know, when you get older and you start to learn more about yourself and you learn what your strengths are and you kind of focus on those, but you don't really know what your weaknesses are so much. But I found out that day that, you know, I had an envious spirit in me that wasn't very nice. And so essentially what happened was I phoned my wife and I spoke to her, and she came back from her office, and it was about 6 o'clock in the evening, and we were talking about it, and we prayed about it a little bit, and it just, the rage was not subsiding. So I basically take off from our apartment, and we live near a place called Versailles, where the famous palace is, and I just took my keys and I headed out the door, and I went for this like 45 minute walk, and the rage just kept building. And I remember, you know, just tears running down my face as I was walking these side streets. And I remember looking up at this cathedral and seeing these like Christmas decorations blowing in the wind. And it was kind of like a very poignant moment. And as I walked away, I turned around and I was face to face with this little bistro, this one guy sitting on a bar stool and the French guy in his apron in cleaning glasses. And I just remember saying to myself, I'm going to get wasted. Like, I'm just like, screw this. I'm going for it. And I remember putting my hand on each pocket of my jeans, and I'd forgotten to bring my wallet and I forgot to bring my phone. And I thought, wow. Because even if I didn't have any money, I probably would have phoned a friend and, you know, conned some money out of him or something. But I was just stuck there, and I walked home and I walked in the door, and my wife just looked at me and she knew. And she thought two things were going to happen. One, I was going to find a way to get hammered, or another way was I was going to like throw myself off a bridge or something. And like when I came in, we just both burst into tears, and I could see the wallet and I could see the phone, and I just knew that like, God's hand was over me, because it could have went so many other ways. Like that was a fork in the road. And even as I'm talking to you, like, my mind is reflecting back how different, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation if that had happened. And I just was so thankful that I didn't drink.
Wow, Malcolm, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. A incredibly powerful look at what addiction steals from us and how we can reclaim our lives once again. I would encourage you to connect with Malcolm on Instagram. He is an incredibly inspiring fellow, and I encourage you to follow him at Malcolm Writer. His name, Malcolm, and the word writer, W-R-I-T-E-R, writer, as an author. And Malcolm Writer, you can follow him there. He shares inspirational ideas and helpful insights to overcoming addiction and fear, and how to face your struggles with courage. He is amazing. You'll be inspired by him. And make sure to follow him on Instagram at Malcolm Writer, W-R-I-T-E-R. All right. Thanks, friends, for listening. Don't forget to register for the Strongest Workshop. Spots are filling up fast. All the details are at my website at mikefoster.tv. We have an amazing group coming. I would just love for you to join us. It's going to be a special time. I want to say thanks to Sleeping at Last for all the beautiful music. Make sure to share this episode online. If you have enjoyed this conversation, make sure to share online. Leave a quick review on iTunes. Follow me on Instagram. I'm MikeFoster2000. MikeFoster2000 on Instagram. And remember, no matter what has happened in your story, that your setbacks can become your superpowers, and honesty is always the best policy. We'll see you next time on the Fun Therapy Podcast.